This is Fresh Air Weekend. I'm David Bean Cooley of the website TV Worth Watching, in for Terry Gross. Our first guest, Michael Fassbender, has starred in 4 movies in the past year. In A Dangerous Method, he played Carl Jung in a film about the relationship between Jung and Sigmund Freud. In Jane Eyre, he was Mr. Rochester. In X-Men First Class, he was a mutant villain. And in Shame, Fassbender played a sex addict, which earned him a Golden Globe nomination. Shame was directed by Steve McQueen, who also directed Fassbender, in his starring role in Hunger. In that film, he portrayed Bobby Sands, the IRA leader who conducted a hunger strike while in prison. Fassbender not only got to co-star in Quentin Tarantino's Inglourious Basterds, he got to do a classic Tarantino-Mexican standoff. Terry spoke with Fassbender last week. Let's start with a scene from A Dangerous Method. Fassbender is playing Carl Jung, trying out the talking cure on his patient, Sabina Spielrein.
I'm Dr. Jung. I admitted you yesterday. Let me explain what I have in mind. I propose that we meet here, most days, to talk for an hour or two.
Talk?
Yes, just talk. See if we can identify what's troubling you. So as to distract you as little as possible, I'm going to sit there. Behind you. I'm going to ask you to try not to turn around and look at me under any circumstances.
Michael Fassbender, welcome to Fresh Air. I think it's almost funny that back-to-back you did a movie about a sex addict and about Freud and Jung debating about whether the roots of all neuroses are sexual. So did the things, I don't know what the sequence was that you shot it in, but did the research you were doing into Freud and Jung come into play in understanding your character in Shame, your sex-addicted character?
Not really, to be honest. The way that I work is that when I'm involved in something, I get sort of really intensely involved in that. But then I'm pretty good at sort of washing it away once I finish it. And pretty much, well, forgetting it is a bit of an extreme word, but definitely sort of it's no longer in my psyche. By the time I got to Shame, I wasn't really thinking at all about Carl Gustav Jung. It was just then about really sort of getting inside the head of the character. And the bulk of my work would come down to the script. I spend a lot of time with the script, reading it, rereading it, rereading, 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 till you go kind of a little bit crazy with it, and then read some more.
If I was interviewing your character of Brandon in Shame, a question I'd want to ask is, do you get any pleasure from sex at all? Because although he's consumed with sex and has as much of it as he can and is on the internet porn sites all the time, it doesn't seem to actually give him pleasure.
You know, I think there is definitely an element of pleasure in there. It would be the similar circumstance if you think, let's sort of make that parallel to an alcoholic, where obviously there, you know, an alcoholic does enjoy a drink, but it gets to a point where when you wake up in the morning, you have to get a bottle of liquor in your system just in order to function. For me, looking at it as trying to sort of understand the character and actually try and reveal what's going on within the character, the psyche of the character, I did take each individual sex scene as a way for me to show the audience what was going on inside the character's head. When you see Brandon at the beginning engaging with a prostitute, you understand that there is an element of control there, that he is controlling the scenario, that he pays the prostitute, she performs a ritual for him, he pays her money, she leaves, she takes her baggage with her, and that's it. It's clean for him. It's easy. There's no emotional responsibility there, definitely not that emotional intimacy. So that's the first glimpse of that. Skip ahead to the scene with Marianne, his office worker, played by Nicole Beharie. He's desperately trying to find intimacy, and that's why he sort of goes and sort of engages in this relationship and does it very clumsily. He takes her to the hotel and essentially can't perform because this is becoming too intimate for him. And immediately after that, we see him very physically engaging with the random woman up against the window, and it's almost like he's reaffirming himself. And then, of course, we have that sort of, the threesome scene or the foursome, because it's almost like the camera and the audience are in there, in the scene with the characters. You kind of see everything combined there, the need for the hit, the desperation, the self-loathing, and the lust, you know, and that kind of helped me sort of, you know, get over the embarrassment about sort of, you know, being naked and sort of, you know, performing these how would I put it, compromising positions. You know, I really wanted to concentrate on what the character was going through. So it's not about titillation, it's more about sort of investigation.
So I don't know if you'll mind my bringing this up. There seems to be a lot of subtext in Shame. And what I kind of read into the script is that Brandon, your character, has had some kind of incestuous relationship in the past with his sister, played by Carey Mulligan, because the first time he sees her, she's kind of moved into his apartment without his permission. And he opens up the bathroom door and there she is naked in the shower. And she doesn't flinch. It's kind of clear he's seen this before. And he's angry with her and makes her put her towel on. But you know that they have some kind of history. Do you mind my saying that? And do
no, not at all. I mean, you know, that's exactly what we wanted to show. And
so you talked about that. You talked about the subtext and the history, even though we don't absolutely know it.
Yeah, for sure we did. Yeah, absolutely. We had discussions. And then we all had our individual, I think, takes on it. And we never really really fixed anything definite on it. And what we didn't want was a scene where they're sitting down going, hey, remember that summer when whatever, you know, it's like, I'm already checked out when I hear that sort of stuff. It's like, let the audience fill in the blanks. They're intelligent enough to do that. And also we didn't want to have any sort of cop-out. No, what was very clear to me from the beginning was I wanted Brandon to be an everyday guy. I wanted him to be somebody that you would recognize at work, or out in a bar, or on the tube. And I wanted to keep them very close to myself and not have any sort of cop-out, oh, wow, look at the, you know, sex addicts. They're the guys in the sort of Rain Max with the sweaty palms in the corner. You know, I wanted them very much to be one of us, one of everybody.
Yeah, so why don't we hear a clip from Shame? And this is you and Carey Mulligan, who plays your sister, and you're sitting on the couch together. This is after she's moved in uninvited. This is after you've really tried to get her to leave. She makes you so uncomfortable. You're just incredibly, like, neat, almost to the point of having, like, a sterile apartment. She's kind of really messy.
Absolutely.
You're just, like, emotionally shut in. She's really emotionally needy and emotionally big and broad. So you're basically telling her it's time for her to leave, and you're sitting on the couch in your living room. So here's my guests, Michael Fassbender and Carey Mulligan.
This isn't working out, obviously. You need to find somewhere else to live.
I don't have anywhere else to go. This isn't about him. I make you angry all the time. And I don't know why.
No. You trap me. You force me into a corner, and you trap me. I've got nowhere else to go. I mean, what sort of is that?
You're my brother.
So what? I'm responsible for you.
Yes.
No, I'm not.
Yes, you are.
No, I didn't give birth to you. I didn't bring you into this world.
You're my brother. I'm your sister. We're family. We're meant to look after each other.
You're not looking after me.
I'm
looking after myself.
I'm trying. I'm trying to help you.
How are you helping me, huh? How are you helping me? How are you helping me?
That's a scene from Shame with my guest Michael Fassbender and Carey Mulligan as his sister.
Yeah.
So I want to ask you about Jane Eyre, in which you played Mr. Rochester. I know when I read the book, like in high school, I guess, I really couldn't understand why the young Jane Eyre fell for Mr. Rochester, who was so much older. He seemed like an old uptight man to me.
An old grumpy git.
Yeah, exactly. But in the film, I just really felt this like intellectual connection that Jane Eyre and Mr. Rochester establish with each other, that they're both, in their own way, outside of the boundaries of conventional society, and no one understands either of them, but they understand each other. Do you remember what you thought of the novel when you first read it?
Yeah, I mean, all those things that you were thinking, I was like, well, you know, where does the attraction come here from? You know, I don't know how many times Rochester tells her to sit down and come here and sort of orders her around. It's kind of, I don't know, some sort of power play, I guess. I really wanted to focus on what you said. You know, the fact that Rochester talks on an equal level with the governess alone would have been not good in that time period, talking about social etiquettes, Victorian England. I mean, that was not the done thing. And you know, the fact that he is a sort of rebel within that, he does not like this sort of social class that he's a part of. And, you know, the intellectual side of him is there, but, you know, you said that they sort of understand each other. He really needs her more than she needs him, I think, and that's what I always thought, that she has the capability of saving him from, you know, this sort of, he's such a closed sort of package, you know, because he's like, the times that he has opened himself up, he's got burnt, you know, and pretty badly. So he prefers to sort of keep a cold exterior on things and protect himself. But slowly but surely, she manages to sort of peel away these sort of defenses. And my problem was really, how, you know, he's locked his wife up in the attic. No wonder she's trying to burn the house down, you know. And again, we're talking about Victorian England. And you know, if a woman was sexually active in that time, she would be seen to sort of perhaps have a mental illness. So I kind of had to sort of, you know, just tell myself, no, she's crazy for sure. It runs in the family. He tried his best, you know. But that's pretty dark, that concept alone.
So let's hear a scene from Jane Eyre. And this is, you know, early on when Jane Eyre has just recently become the governess and she's just met Mr. Rochester, the owner of the estate in which she's working. And they're sitting by the fire talking. And I think this kind of shows the kind of mix of condescension and respect that Mr. Rochester is demonstrating towards Jane Eyre. So this is my guest, Michael Fassbender and Mia Wasikowska.
Come, speak to me. Fact is, Miss Eyre, I'd like to draw you out. Rather, a look of another world about you. I don't wish to treat you as inferior.
Yet you command me to speak.
You're very hurt by my tone of command.
There are a few masters who trouble to inquire whether their paid subordinates were hurt by their commands.
Paid subordinate? I'd forgotten the salary. Well, on that mercenary ground, will you consent to speak as my equal without thinking that the request arises from insolence?
I've never mistaken formality for insolence, sir. One are rather like the other. Nothing freeborn should ever submit to.
Humbug.
Even for a salary.
Most freeborn things would submit to anything for a salary. But I mentally shake hands with you for your answer. Not 3,000 schoolgirl governesses would have answered me as you've just done.
Then you've not spent much time in our company, sir. I'm the same plain kind of bird as all the rest, with my common tale of woe.
I envy you.
How?
Your openness, your unpolluted mind. When I was your age, fate dealt me a blow. And since happiness is denied me, I have a right to get pleasure in its stead. And I will get it, cost what it may.
There's a poetic quality to my dialogue. I mean, there's an aspect I've always said that it's you know, it's not poetry, but it's kind of like it. It's not song lyrics, but it's kind of like song lyrics. It's not rap, but it's kind of like rap. And it's not stand-up comedy, but it is kind of like stand-up comedy. It's all those things together. And there's wordplay and there's rhythms and you have to be able to get the poetry out of it. You have to be able to sell my jokes.
Okay, so that's Quentin Tarantino talking about what he requires in an actor to do his dialogue. So when you work with Tarantino on Inglourious Basterds, did he talk to you at all about the rhythms, about selling his jokes, about all the stuff we just heard him discuss?
Well, I think, you know, actors get it because the dialogue, you really just have to follow the dialogue and you know, 80% of the work is done. And sometimes he will give you the cadence correctly if you're not getting the rhythms right. But it was something that I luckily came across pretty early when I decided that I wanted to sort of do acting. You know, I put on a play of Reservoir Dogs in Killarney, the town that I grew up in. And so, you know, one of my classmates and I, we just, you know, we would work on this script. And we all, you know, at the age of 18, we were like, this script is amazing, isn't it? The rhythms and the flow.
Were you in high school when you did this, or college?
High school.
This is great. So, like, you're in high school and you're doing a theater adaptation of Quentin Tarantino's Reservoir Dogs, which is about all these guys pulling a heist and getting followed by the police and so on. So it's a really violent film.
Yeah.
So did your teachers think, great idea, yes?
Yeah, I don't know, did we disclose what we were doing? But, they were very supportive because we started off. I had joined this sort of theatre company for the sort of 5 months before, so I had been doing pantomime and pub theatre and various sort of sketch forms of theatre. And then I sort of, you know, got together with my friends and we decided to actually film our version of Reservoir Dogs in the locker room at school. And so we didn't have a camera, so one of the teachers, you know, had a camera, he gave us that, and sort of they were like, off you go. I think, you know, that my school was always sort of encouraging people, you know, if you're being productive and if you're taking on, you know, challenges, they were very supportive.
So did Quentin Tarantino know about this when he cast you in Inglourious Basterds?
Well, I told him when I went in for the audition, and I was like, look, you know, we gave all the money to charity. And he's like, that's cool, man, as long as you're not making any money off my And so I was like, and so, you know, that was a nice little icebreaker. And then we sat down and I auditioned for him. And, the great thing about Quentin is, you know, his passion for film and for text and for all his sort of characters as well, no matter how small, you know, there'd be a character that's got two lines in his script, but he knows that whole backstory of the character. He loves the character very much. And so he reads all the other characters with you. So that's that was quite surreal.
No, it's really funny. You know, Quentin Tarantino is like such a great writer of dialogue. And, you know, he compares it to writing poetry or music or rap. But most of your part in Inglourious Basterds is done in German. You're a British film critic who's now in the military. It's World War II. And you're recruited to be in something called Operation Kino. And the idea is that the leadership of the Nazis are going to this Nazi propaganda film debut. So the goal is to kind of kill them while they're all gathered together there. So you're supposed to be meeting a German film star who's actually a spy for the British. And she set up this meeting in a little pub in occupied France. And unfortunately, the pub is filled with German soldiers when you meet her there. And it's a basement pub, so there's no easy escape. And so you have to fake that you're a German soldier. So mm-hmm. The dialogue's all in German. And did Quentin understand a word of German?
You know, it's funny, I'll just sort of say, who else would have a film critic heading out as a sort of undercover spy?
So
I love
it.
Quentin doesn't speak German, and he doesn't speak French, but there was times when, you know, French actors were speaking French, and they changed something in his dialogue, and he'd be like, wait a second, what did you do there? And they were like, nothing. And they were like, he's like, you changed something. And they were like, yeah, just a little bit. And he's like, don't do that. You know, and the same with the German. He's got a great I don't know. He's got a great intuition and an ear for rhythms and tone, I think. And so even if he may not understand it sort of word for word, he's almost sort of tapped into the sort of rhythm and tone of the piece.
Okay, so this is going to be weird, but I'm going to play a clip of you in that pub speaking in German and trying to convince this German soldier who kind of knows something's fishy going on and doesn't really think you have a very believable German accent.
And so Shall I do the subtitles?
Yes, yeah. Why don't we hear it and then you could do the subtitles. Yes. So you're trying to convince him that you're an officer, you're his superior, and it's time for him to leave because he's being intrusive. So here's you, and then we hear the German soldier at the very end.
Sie haben vielleicht nicht die Gastfreundschaft des Fräuleins mit ihrem betrunkenen, rüpelhaften Benehmen strapaziert, aber sehr wohl die meine. Darf ich Sie erinnern, Oberfeldwebel? Sie sind Soldat, das ist ein Offizierstisch! Ich schlage vor, dass Sie das Fräulein nicht weiter belästigen und an Ihren Tisch zurückkehren.
Entschuldigen Sie, Hauptsturmführer, Sie haben einen sehr ungewöhnlichen Akzent. Woher kommen Sie?
So what the German soldier is saying at the end is, excuse me, Captain, but your accent is very unusual. Where are you from?
Yeah, exactly.
So how did you...
That's when you go, oh,
yes,
no.
Right, yeah, you know, trouble ahead, and boy, it gets really bloody after a while. How did you learn to speak German? I know you were born in Germany, lived there till the age of two, and then moved to Ireland with your family. So your father is German, your mother is Irish. So did you already know German when you shot Inglourious Basterds?
You know, I sort of, you know, my mom, when they moved to Germany, I think all in all they were there for 6 years. And so my mom sort of learned German as well. So both of them, you know, obviously fluent in German, and they used to try and speak German at home with me. But I don't know, I never really wanted to. I guess I was kind of embarrassed or something silly. I can understand the bulk of it, but speaking it, I would definitely give away that it would be obvious immediately that I wasn't German with my accent. And so I worked with a fantastic voice coach, and she recorded it, I recorded, and then I just sort of played it back, you know, over and over again, and just, you know, again, the sort of repetition thing to really sort of hone in on the sort of, you know, the sounds and to get the rhythms right, so that it wouldn't be sort of so obvious to a German public that they'd be like, well, he's obviously not German, you know.
So you're getting a lot of recognition now. You were nominated for a Golden Globe. Did you ever expect to be in the world of, like, award shows and stuff like that in Hollywood?
Yes. you know, when you start off, you sort of really... I think because the business is so... you're so dependent on others in terms of sort of getting any work that you have to have a very strong self-belief system. And, you know, from the beginning, when I decided that I wanted to do it, I believed that I could do this job well. I always said I'm good enough to be working. That was always the mantra when I sort of wasn't working for long periods of time. And, of course, you know, this position now is the dream, you know. You dream about sort of getting to this position. It's a position that you couldn't get to without people helping you enormously along the way, and luck and timing. Being in the right place at the right time, getting the right role, having the right director sort of work with you on that role, all those things.
Michael Fassbender, thank you very much. It's been great to talk with you.
Likewise, Terry.
Thank you again. Be well.
Thank you.
Michael Fassbender speaking with Terry Gross. Fassbender stars in the current films Shame and A Dangerous Method. Let's hear the rest of that scene from Inglourious Basterds. Michael Fassbender's character, a British spy, has been discovered, and he's now in a Mexican standoff, guns drawn, with a Nazi soldier.
Well, if this is it, old boy, I hope you don't mind if I go out speaking to kings.
By all means, Captain.
There's a special rung in hell reserved for people who waste good scotch. Seeing as I may be rapping on the door momentarily... I must say, damn good stuff, sir. Now, about this pickle we find ourselves in, it would appear there's only one thing left for you to do.
And what would that be?
Stiglitz.
See how feeders into your Nazi boss.
For many years now, the search for unknown or forgotten soul singers has led deep into musical archives. Yet new music is also out there waiting to be rediscovered. Music critic Milo Miles says one of the best finds is the West African singer and bandleader El Rego. A new album collects his singles from the late 60s and early 70s.
It may seem counterintuitive, but the history of world music proves that unfamiliar instruments and rhythms cross borders much more readily than vocal styles. There's no question that starting in the late 60s, soul and then funk became very popular in sub-Saharan Africa. Decades of reissues show that a lot of players found their way into electric guitar, and that enriching the big beat of the West was a cinch for African percussionists. Regarding singers, only South Africa had a gospel tradition that was ready for soul from the get-go. An additional handicap for many countries was that while young bands enjoyed jamming on funk riffs and rhythms, they were more comfortable with folk forms and were not notably skilled at writing what the West would consider tight pop songs. El Rego from Benin in West Africa has no such problems with his first album available in the U.S., a collection of vintage 45s. From the start, his band The Commandos is in the pocket, and the leader's phrasing and tone connects right away. Of course, there's lots of James Brown in there, but while other Benin singers of the period are more scary than funky when they echo Soul Brother No. 1, El Rego makes restraint sound not only like more fun, but more insightful. His confident flair with soul is a bit mysterious. He was not a precocious, obsessive fan. Rego and the Commandos were trying to give the people what they wanted as much as anything. And indeed, the first track on the El Rego collection features a vocal by the guest singer who showed them the way, the wonderfully named Eddie Black Power.
Your need. All right. Lord, I know.
As always with international music, however, language can erect barriers. One song, available only as a download or as a bonus 45 with the vinyl version of the album, tells a poignant story of two blind men who decide to commit suicide together by jumping in the river. But if you can't understand the words, the story does not improve the tune. El Rego's backstory does enhance another track, which is dedicated to the Marxist Revolution of 1972. El Rego explains in his liner notes that as part of a crackdown on personal freedoms in general, and nightlife in particular, he was arrested and told he would be released if he wrote a pro-revolution song. He had to agree, but he couldn't help but make it a very melancholic blues. And that's exactly what it sounds like, a praise song written at gunpoint. The funky party days are over in Benin, but the El Rego collection insists that they not be forgotten.
Milo Miles reviewed El Rego on Daptone Records. When someone thinks of mushrooms, oftentimes they're thinking of dinner. When our next guest, Nicholas Money, thinks mushrooms, he thinks about fungal sex organs that are the most wondrous inventions of the last billion years of evolutionary history on Earth. He's an expert on mushrooms and other fungi, including the molds you don't want growing in your home. He's a professor of botany at Miami University in Ohio and the author of the new book, Mushroom. His other books include The Triumph of the Fungi, A Rotten History, and Carpet Monsters and Killer Spores. Nicholas Money spoke with Terry last week.
Nicholas Money, welcome to Fresh Air. Mushrooms sometimes grow in places where you really don't want to see them. My worst example of that is the mushrooms that were once growing on my kitchen ceiling in a rented apartment. I woke up one day and I thought, it can't be. It can't be that my ceiling has mushrooms on it. But upon closer examination, they were definitely mushrooms. I think there was like a leak that had gone undetected and, you know, like water had been seeping. And it was just, it was a very surreal experience. So what are some of the most inappropriate places you've seen mushrooms?
I rented an apartment years ago in New Haven, and there were mushrooms there that were growing. Actually, these were cup fungi, large things that were growing around the wooden surround of the bathtub.
Oh.
And they're absolutely revolting. So for even somebody that loves the fungi, this was really quite disconcerting. But far worse than that is a photograph that I've seen of a mushroom, an ink cap, a mushroom actually growing in the throat of a patient in some very unfortunate individual whose immune system was really crashing. And actually a mushroom growing in that location is something that none of us want to experience.
Why would mushrooms be growing indoors, like in your bathroom or on my kitchen ceiling?
Fungi grow on a multitude of different substrates, a multitude of different food sources. And so in our homes, if there are areas of damp wood, flooring, carpeting, drywall, you name it, fungi are going to grow there if those food sources become damp. And because the spores of fungi are everywhere, I mean, every breath that we take, from first breath to last gasp, we're inhaling fungal spores. And so they're always available. They're always in the air, ready to exploit to them useful opportunities to grow and reproduce.
Now, you describe mushrooms as fungal sex organs, and they have a very weird way of reproducing. Now, you've taken high-speed video of mushrooms releasing their spores. So it's high-speed video so that when it's played back, it visually slows down the process and we can actually see what's happening, and you were able to calculate the speed that the spores are being released. So tell us what you learned from these high-speed videos, and maybe you could describe what one or two of them looks like.
Well, it's been known for a long time, over a century, that mushrooms release astonishing numbers of spores. You can actually see them if you put a flashlight beneath a mushroom in the woods at night, and you can see these clouds of spores, this dust being released from the bottom of the cap. So individual mushrooms can release as many as 30,000 spores a second. Absolutely astonishing. And billions of spores in a single day. But the process of spore release from the gills of the mushroom occurs.
What are the gills?
So the gills, if we look underneath the cap of a mushroom, there's a number of different arrangements of the fertile surface in this sex organ that we're going to see. So in many cases, we see gills. In the case of boletes and a number of other different groups of mushrooms, there are tiny tubes beneath the cap.
So what did you see?
So the mechanism in mushrooms involves the movement of tiny droplets of fluid, and they condense on the spore surface under wet conditions, and then they coalesce, they move together, they jump together very, very swiftly. This is on a time scale of millionths of a second, and it's that very fast movement in the center of mass of the structure that kicks it into the air. So it's this microscopic leap that occurs as the spores jump from the gill surfaces. It really is absolutely extraordinary. If we scale this up to human dimensions, or if we were jumping off gills, we'd be moving at 500 times the speed of sound to really match the prowess, the elegance of these fungi.
A mushroom that seems like a particular oddity, its name describes it. It's called the Phallus impudicus, and it's a penis-shaped mushroom that really smells foul. What sets this mushroom apart, and why does it smell so bad?
There's a number of these phallic, foul-smelling mushrooms that we find particularly in tropical ecosystems, but they do grow in the eastern United States and elsewhere. And these are mushrooms that have actually given up this mechanism of spore discharge from gill surfaces, and we're talking about giving up over the course of a long period of evolutionary history. And they've done so in favor of dispersing their spores by using insects to actually suck up the spore mass, this stinking spore mass, and then as the insects fly away, eventually they deposit the spores far from the parent mushroom. So it's a completely different mechanism of dispersal, but it's one that we see quite frequently among the mushrooms. The phallic shape actually makes sense just in terms of actually carrying this stinking spore mass into the air. I mean, the mushroom has to achieve this erection from a buried egg, and then this thing will, you know, be up to 5-6 inches long and attract slugs and snails and flies, actually a lot of other kinds of flying insects, towards this horrible mass of spores.
So it's the smell that attracts the insects. The smell that smells foul to us attracts them.
Yeah, these mushrooms actually produce a compound called cadaverine and other kinds of foul-smelling chemicals that actually seem to mimic the smells released from decaying corpses in the forest. And so the kinds of insects that they attract are those that would otherwise perhaps be visiting a dead squirrel or something like that.
So what makes certain mushrooms hallucinogenic?
So there are a number of species of mushrooms that contain alkaloids. That these are the chemicals that interact with our nervous systems in very, very specific ways. So the fly agaric mushroom, this iconic thing with a red cap and the white spots, that contains a couple of different hallucinogenic compounds that apparently give one the sensation of flying. That's one of the sensations that's reported by people that enjoy fly agaric mushrooms. And there are other mushrooms. These are species of psilocybe, and they contain compounds that actually mimic. They look a lot like chemically. They're almost indistinguishable from serotonin, and they really play havoc with our nervous systems, and they affect the way that our neocortex operates, and they're responsible for a whole range of different hallucinations.
Now, you say that there are current research trials on the possible medical uses of psilocybin. What are they investigating?
There have been some really, really interesting studies out of Johns Hopkins in the last few years where patients have been given specific doses of psilocybin in a clinical setting. And one of the things that's interesting about those studies is that these people are going on mushroom trips in the lab setting, and they describe those experiences. Months later, in the follow-up studies, they say that these hallucinations, the experiences that they had under the influence of the mushrooms, are among the most profoundly moving experiences of their lives, both positively and negatively, as important perhaps as falling in love for the first time, the birth of a child.
So what are researchers at Johns Hopkins hoping to be able to use psilocybin for?
One thing that the researchers at Johns Hopkins are looking at now is the use of these magic mushrooms, or rather these hallucinogenic compounds, to actually improve the quality of life for patients suffering from terminal diseases, since it really seems to be for perhaps the majority of people that actually take these compounds that it's actually an uplifting experience rather than a negative one. And so there really might be these could be used in a therapeutic setting and perhaps be very powerful agents in the future.
If you're just joining us, my guest is Nicholas Money. He's the author of the book Mushroom. One of his earlier books is called Carpet Monsters and Killer Spores, A Natural History of Toxic Mold. I'd like to talk with you a little bit about toxic mold. Are killer spores related to mushrooms?
Well, there are hundreds of thousands of different species of fungi. We've only actually described 70-odd thousand species. Most of the fungi are microscopic things that never produce anything as large as a mushroom. So we might refer to these as molds. There are other technical names for these fungi. But yeah, most of the things are never going to produce a mushroom.
So your title is Carpet Monsters and Killer Spores. What do you mean by carpet monster?
Fungi will grow anywhere that suitable food source is available, and carpets actually make a pretty good dining experience for a number of different species of fungi if they become wet.
The way we live now with the new kinds of materials that we live with, have we broadened or decreased the food that fungi can feed on indoors?
Oh, we're always broadening the range of opportunities for the fungi. I mean, they're going to thrive and outlive us by an eternity. Fungi can grow on almost any substrate, any kind of material. There are some famous cases of fungi growing in all kinds of unusual situations, growing on the bloom on camera lenses, for example. There's enough nutritional resources on a camera lens to support the growth of a fungal colony. Fungi have been found growing within fuel lines in airplanes and so forth. So, no, there really is no limit to their nutritional flexibility.
Now, you write that invisible monsters in the carpet came close to asphyxiating you when you were a child growing up in England because you had asthma. When did you find out what the cause was?
That's right. So I grew up in England in the 1960s, and I was quite profoundly asthmatic as a kid. It's something, thankfully, that I've grown out of to a large degree in adulthood. But I'm not sure that we could ever have proved that fungi were the cause of my allergies. But I remember that my mother actually removed the carpet from my bedroom and went to rather extraordinary lengths to try and sort of create this clean living space in which I wouldn't suffer from these asthma attacks. But it's rather ironic then, having suffered as an infant from probable exposure to allergenic fungal spores, that I then spend, the next many decades of my life studying fungi.
Now, you also describe yourself as a hypochondriac, so I think...
Oh, absolutely.
A hypochondriac with allergies and asthma studying funguses and molds, it's not necessarily a great combination.
I met a therapist. I engaged in some therapy 20 years ago or so.
Ran into a therapist.
He actually pointed this out, and it came to me as a profound revelation. I'd never made this connection. It's like this guy that's such a hypochondriac, and yet studies death and mold and decay, and is really just immersed in the study of decomposition.
Well, I think it's often true that what repulses us also attracts us. That there's this kind of ugly beauty thing.
That's probably better therapy there than I received 20 years ago.
Well, Nicholas Money, I want to thank you so much for talking with us.
Thank you so much.
Nicholas Money speaking with Terry Gross. Money is the author of the new book, Mushroom, and is a professor of botany at Miami University in Ohio. Every year, the Academy Award for Best Foreign Language Film is chosen from movies nominated by their home countries, one submission per country. This year's Mexican submission is Miss Bala, a story set amidst Mexico's drug war. Miss Bala opens this weekend in American theaters, and our critic at large, John Powers, says that it grippingly captures a society shot through with fear.
If you read the headlines, you know that the Mexican government is engaged in a long, deadly battle against the country's astonishingly powerful drug dealers, known as narcotraficantes, or simply narcos. Hardly a day goes by without news of another shootout or massacre. Nearly 50,000 people have died in the current five-year-old drug war, the majority of them innocent citizens. Naturally, such a reality has a painful effect on the psyches of ordinary people forced to live amidst the madness. And this is the subject of a remarkable new movie, Miss Bala, written and directed by the brilliant young Mexican filmmaker Gerardo Naranjo. Focusing on the absurd travails of one young woman, this searing, exaggerated, sometimes weirdly funny film plays like a cross between Franz Kafka and No Country for Old Men. Set in and around Tijuana in the northern Mexican state of Baja, Miss Bala tells the story of Laura Guerrero, played by Stephanie Sigmund, a pretty, innocent 23-year-old whose family runs a clothes stall. Laura has big dreams, and to make them come true, she enters the Miss Baja beauty pageant. So far, so good. But after entering, she follows her friend Suzu to a disco, and there things go terribly wrong. Narcos burst in and start gunning people down. Laura escapes, just barely. But when she tries to find out what happened to Suzu, she makes a fateful mistake. She asks the help of a policeman. Before she knows it, she's in the hands of Lino Valdez, a dangerously capricious drug boss played by Noe Hernandez. Laura desperately wants to get away, but there's nowhere safe to go. And so Lino uses her to perform tasks she doesn't want to do for men whose intentions she rarely understands. All she knows is that wherever she turns up, people get killed. Laura goes from hoping to be Miss Baja to becoming Miss Bala, which is Spanish for bullet. Now, there are a lot of bullets in Miss Bala, But part of what makes the film so masterful is its striking way of portraying violence. You see, most violent movie scenes are shot and edited to make the killing and mayhem as exciting as possible. The camera, we might say, encourages us to identify with the violence, either by making it seem cool or by focusing on a hero whose own violence we're urged to cheer on. Naranjo does just the opposite. While his movie is very exciting, there are three riveting set pieces, he keeps us focused on the point of view of Lara, who's a victim. Using superbly orchestrated long takes, he either shows us what Lara's seeing, or more often, simply focuses on her face as murderous events unfold around her. The soul of the film is her fear. In Lara's face, we see the terror and dread that have become normal in a Mexico where the drug trade touches everyone and everything, even a goofy Miss Baja contest. When I first saw Miss Bala, I kept thinking that Lara was too passive and that Sigma needed to show more fire in her performance. Watching it again, I realized I'd been expecting her to be the heroine of a Hollywood movie. But Laura's not. She's a not-rich young woman living in a place where, if you're a not-rich young woman in trouble, there's nowhere to go and no one to trust. You never know who that cop is really working for, or whether that famous general in charge of fighting a cartel may himself be one of its bosses. Pointedly over the top, Miss Bala offers a vision of Mexico that must surely have the National Tourist Board clutching its collective head in dismay. After all, just as there was more to life in Miami than you saw in the old Al Pacino movie Scarface, there's obviously far more to this country of 120 million people than drug dealers, corrupt officials, and their victims. Yet the fact that Naranjo's movie is his country's official Oscar nominee suggests that, while it may not tell the whole story of Mexican life, it clearly captures a reality nobody can deny. Early on, when Laura tells her father she's going to enter the Miss Baja contest, he urges her not to. He says she could wind up in trouble, making it clear that it's better to keep your head down. It sounds like good advice, but the painful truth is that this good advice wouldn't have helped Laura at all. In the Mexico of Miss Bala, you can never get your head down far enough.
John Powers is film and TV critic for Vogue and Vogue.com. You can see the trailer for Miss Bala on our website, freshair.npr.org, where you can also download podcasts of the show. Fresh Air Weekend was produced by John Sheehan. Fresh Air's executive producer is Danny Miller. Our engineer is Audrey Bentham. Our interviews and reviews are produced and edited by Amy Sallet, Phyllis Myers, Roberta Sharrock, Anne-Marie Baldonado, Sam Brigger, Lauren Krenzel, John Myers, Heidi Simon, and Teresa Madden. Our administrative assistant is Dorothy Farragut. Melody Kramer is our associate producer for online media. For Terry Gross, I'm David B. Incouli.